Welcome to this podcast produced by Imagine, your resource for early childhood music therapy. Imagine is produced by Della Vista Publisher and can be found on the web at www.imagine.musictherapy.biz. The title of this podcast is Finding a Way to Make It Work and features Jody Click in an interview with Dana Bolton.
Hello, I'm Dana Bolton, the associate editor of the Imagine magazine. Welcome to Jody Click. Thank you for joining me today on this Imagine podcast. As music therapists and private music teachers, we know that when we think outside the box, we can create successful music experiences for children of all ability levels. In this year's Imagine podcast series, we would like to find out how you make music accessible to young learners, what kind of adaptation you make or assistance you give, and in which ways this support transforms the participation and engagement of your clients. So here are 10 questions for you. So first of all, where do you work and what is your role?
I am teaching private piano, guitar, voice lessons. And then I also do music and movement and early intervention a little bit, and just some other music sessions with teens and kids with disabilities, just as it comes up. If they're not succeeding in another instrument, then we switch to music and movement. So
you just do a little bit of everything.
I do a little bit of everything.
So what everyday situation comes to your mind when you hear about adaptive music making in early childhood settings?
Well, I was a special education teacher previously for 20 years. So I did a lot with adapting instruments just for students with physical disabilities to be able to hold them and use them. But in private lessons, I do that still as well, but also more of adapting that one-on-one with students who maybe are struggling with an instrument. You see a lot of struggles with frustration levels that I maybe didn't see as much in the school. But a student who maybe doesn't want to play the piano because they're afraid they'll hit a wrong note and they completely shut down. So focusing on adapting their lessons around that, making music a successful experience all of the time is really important in elementary or in early childhood, because you want them to embrace the music and then learn that they can struggle and then succeed. But they have to have those successful experiences first, so they have that in their back pocket before things get really hard.
Right. That's the great thing about music, is there's always a way to make it successful.
Right.
So in what way can adaptive music making support access and a sense of belonging for young children?
Oh, well, everybody can participate in music. So giving them that opportunity to be with their peers, to do something their peers are doing, to go to lessons, to play an instrument and say that they play an instrument. I have a student who has severe cerebral palsy. And so obviously he wouldn't normally have been able to do piano lessons. So I've been adapting all of the music to be able to be played with one hand, because he can't use the other hand. So to be able to say he goes to piano lessons and does those things when other people are talking about it includes him, as well as learning to read music and be able to participate in those experiences with his family, with his church, and then at school as well. So.
Right. Do you have any tips on how to adapt instruments or music lessons?
Everything that you can think of, you try it. And if it works, it works. I use duct tape, I use masking tape, I use Velcro, I use straps, I use everything. I have a student who plays the drum with a racket ball attached to the top of a door spring, because he can't move his hand very much. So if he moves it a little bit, the spring makes the ball hit the drum and then spring back without him needing to move his hand. So, I mean, like, if you think they need something, you just hook things together until something works. And you adapt the music to make it work, but it's all about making it successful. And a lot of times I use the adapted instruments with all of the students so that it's not something different. So if one person needs something adapted, then everybody gets that one, because it helps them too, and it doesn't hurt them to play it the other way. And then everybody's playing the same thing, so they're included and don't feel different as well.
Right. And a lot of times the other kids just think it looks cool.
The other kids love it. Yeah. They love playing it. That my door spring instrument is one of my most popular drum mallets in my entire collection, because everybody likes something that boings at them when they play it against the drum. So yeah.
Also adds another interesting sound to it too.
It does. Yes.
How have you meaningfully used assistive technology?
Well, I'm an assistive technology specialist, so I use it a lot. In music lessons, you would think I probably wouldn't use it as much in sessions, but I do. I use it a lot for songwriting. We use it for making sound effects. We use it for obviously answering questions and doing things that you would normally use assistive technology or communication devices for. But giving them that access, we can use electronic keyboards for those who can't use a regular piano and push hard enough. We can adapt that with the touch, adapting the instruments with the assistive technology. I use the switches a lot, and then I also have other students use them so that everybody's answering with switches, which gives them a feeling of learning to wait for a response and having that experience, the same experience that my student with a disability is having. So yeah. They're easy to incorporate.
Are there any specific programs or apps that you use a lot?
I don't use the apps quite so much. I use a couple of voice changing apps for some songs that are fun. Perry Grip, who's the guy that writes for Phineas and Ferb, his songs have fantastic sound effects. So we use the switches and some apps to do voice changing so that we can make any kind of sound, even if they can't vocalize a true word, we make a vocalization and then it changes it to a robot sound or an alien sound. And then we record those into the switches and can make different songs that we use with different sound effects in a row. And that's how we write songs. And so those are some good ones, but I mostly just use a lot of hands-on things that I'm making or pictures. And then obviously the device that maybe someone's already using, programming things into that, that we would use for a music lesson.
For the switches that you use, do you use the switch adapted toys as well, or just switches for
I did more when I was teaching special education. I don't use them as much in music because I like to be able to do more of the hands-on and not waiting for that response. And then also with switches, I have found that all these years we've had these switches and they're so expensive and everybody has like one switch and you're constantly reprogramming it. They have new switches for dogs. And those have the best sound and they record so easily and they're durable because they're for dogs and they're so affordable. Like you can buy 20 of them for the price that used to cost to buy two of like a Big Mac, and they work better and they're faster response. So everybody needs to go out and buy dog buttons for communication and use those with your clients. They're so easy to program. They last longer. The batteries last longer. I'm actually kind of angry that the dogs get better buttons than our students get at half the price. But honestly, the dog buttons are so much better than the buttons that were aimed at our kids all these years. So
oh my gosh.
We use those a lot.
That's the thing with assistive technologies. You just have to get creative.
Yeah, and you do. And it's so expensive to buy the things that are already made. Mm-hmm. So you're always looking for other options.
What kinds of non-standard music notation are a good option for younger children?
I use a lot of pictures. So we put, if we're writing a song where they're accompanying something and someone maybe that's nonverbal, I'll use a lot of pictures that they pick which instruments are going to play in a row. So if they want to play the boomwhackers and then they want the cymbal and then they want the tambourine or whatever they choose, then we put that picture in. And if I'm doing virtual lessons and I put it into a PowerPoint and I already have it made and ready and I just pick whichever one, maybe from two choices that they've selected. I use a lot of boomwhacker colors. I have a student right now that's taking piano lessons, but he refuses to touch the piano. So I'm tricking him into learning his notes with the boomwhackers. And so the notes are still on the staff. He hasn't yet figured out that it's the same staff he uses for the piano, but he's learning to then notate for the boomwhacker on the staff the same way. Or we use the same rhythm things, but maybe we write it on the straight line instead of on the staff as they're starting. But a lot of picture symbols, a lot of instrument pictures, even just notes where they're putting the notes together to start to figure out how that works. So pictures, lots of pictures.
Yeah. And so many of the kids' instruments are already color-coded. And so
right. And a lot of that stuff, you can
option.
Find those pictures so easily online now, where it used to be you'd have to sit and cut them out for hours and download them all. And now you just go to Google Images and you just print and they're ready in 2 minutes. So it's
exactly.
easy to put things together.
So easy.
Yeah.
How do you adapt songwriting for young children?
Again, like the pictures with some, with different instruments, with different words, maybe instead of a word, if it's someone that's not verbal, then we may use like a picture of an image or a place or a thing. We'll do almost like a Mad Libs type of thing. So they're filling in a place or a person. And then I have some options for them to choose from if they can't verbalize all of that or don't have that technology in their device yet. So mm-hmm. We do a lot of things like that. Picking rhythms, I have lots of rhythm cards, so just quarter notes and quarter rests, and they have to put them together. And then sometimes I'll have them combine them with different pitches above or below the rhythm. So they're putting that all together, but they're not having to focus on all the concepts at one time, because telling a student to write something that fills two measures. Well, then they've got to think eight beats and they have to think notes and everything all at one time. So if you have them fill in the notes or the rhythm first, then we go back and we put a pitch with the rhythm. So it's two different cards. And then maybe we put a dynamic with that, or then we pick our different parts. So it helps them focus on each part of it, where normally when we are doing lessons, you know, you're having a kid do that and they're doing two measures and everything has to be all at one time and they can't necessarily break that down yet. So
yeah, that's a good way to break it down into little steps there.
Makes it hands-on too, because normally it's just a pencil and paper. So it's a lot easier if you're putting cards together on a big piece of paper.
Yeah.
So
So this next question is about sort of non-traditional music making environments. So just, you know, thinking, we tend to think of music as being something that is performed, you mm-hmm. know, in a concert hall, by professionals, or, you know, that we do it in music class or we do it at church. So what kind of experience or what do you think of when you think about non-traditional music making environments?
When I was teaching special education, I used music a lot to teach some of my students their letters and how to read. A lot of my students could figure out words, but they, you know, you couldn't teach them to read the normal way. And so I would get those desk bells or the chime bells. And so we would start by reading those in order. And it turns out they could read the letters if they were corresponding with music. And then we would start to put the words to the song with it. And they would sing the song because they would do it by rote or would echo back to me. And then they started to recognize the words of the song, kind of like typically developing children memorize words to their favorite books that you read to them. And then you think, oh, they can read, but they can just read that story. Well, the same thing starts to happen with the music, and it's easier to echo back a song. And so they start to recognize those words to it if you have them start following along with the bells and the chimes and the different instruments. And then they learn those words, and then we'd start to be able to grow from there. And they could learn their alphabet with the chimes. And so those are probably not traditional music making places, because mm-hmm. you're not expecting to walk into a reading lesson and that be a music performance. But I used it a lot for that, because I could get them to echo back words that they wouldn't have otherwise ever have cooperated with trying to learn to read those words. So it worked pretty well.
Yeah. What is your top advice for adaptive music making in early childhood settings?
Try everything, whatever it takes to make it successful. There should never be a negative music making experience. There shouldn't be cuts, and we aren't gatekeepers to music. And I see that a lot with especially private music teachers. They're too young. They don't sit still long enough on the bench. Well, if they won't sit still long enough on the bench, then take them off the bench and go do music on the floor and make a music activity. And don't gatekeep music from anybody. If a kid doesn't practice, who cares? Then you figure out a way to do it in the lesson, and you've got to make it successful, because music has to be the one thing that every single person can do, no matter what. No matter what we have to do, you find the way to make it work, and you do it completely different for every kid. I mean, you can't just teach one way. You have to just find a way to make it work and try everything. I mean, if that doesn't work, then we'll try something different. So
just meet them where they're at.
Yep.
And our last question, what are some resources that you recommend for parents or for other private music teachers?
Honestly, I find the most stuff just Googling things and looking what other people are doing. There's Facebook groups and things too, and I learn from those. But when I'm looking to adapt something or something's not working, I just pick a random key phrase that I need to adapt some instrument, and look at Pinterest pictures and YouTube pictures and videos of others doing different things. It may not even be the same age group or the same instrument, but then I'm like, oh, I could take that and do this and pull that from that and just see what other people are doing. And that's where I get most of my ideas, and then figure out ways to adapt it from there. And then also, you know, groups and networking with other teachers. But I find our kids are so individualized that really you're just taking little tiny nits pieces, and then asking the parents what they're doing at home with something related to that, I can often adapt based off what they do in other settings as well. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much for all your insights and for sharing your time with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this Imagine podcast, produced in 2023.